Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Conversation Ex Nihilo. This is Billy. Not a lot to go over again this week. Imagine that. As COVID marches on, I seem to have less and less to remind me that the days are different than the previous ones. In fact, all I have is this podcast, really, in order to remind myself that this is Friday and it's time to post something. Today I have a very special guest. God, I guess everybody says that, don't they? With every guest, it's a special guest. And she's not special. She's a regular guest. Her name is Carla, and she is a historian. She is a museum conservator. I should have asked her what that proper term is, but either way, I think you're going to find her a very interesting woman. She now also works in a crisis line, and I really wish I would have talked to her a little bit more about that, but I certainly hope to have her on again soon. No major announcements this week. I've been making my way steadily through the top 500 albums of all time by Rolling Stone magazine. I just recently finished Smile by Brian Wilson, number 300 and something, and it's a great album. I absolutely recommend that. I got TLC coming up, Crazy Sexy Cool. It's been a long time since I've listened to that album. I'm really looking forward to checking in with old T-Boss Chili and Lisa Left Eye Lopez and seeing if it still stands up. So I guess without further ado, let me get to Carla. Let's go, watch it bro. We've got a lot of bottles and it's number gross. Hey, yo, here we go. We've got a body, but it's why we look so dope. We disturb the peace.
Gonna be good for the podcast itself.
Awesome.
You know what I mean? So that way I also feel like the guest isn't pressured either. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, you're like, let's just talk about history and conservation. Like, okay. And it's funny because I just started watching Band of Brothers for the first time.
First time ever?
Ever. Ever. I have a hard time.
Who's your favorite brother so far?
I can't keep them straight. They're all like middle-aged white guys with the same haircut. I'm like, I don't know. Like,
I know. They're supposed to be fresh-faced recruits, and they're like obviously all in their 30s.
Right, except for the new ones that just came in. And then one of them that you just like had this little pang of like, oh, you know, and then all of a sudden he's dead with his head blown off. You're like, okay, clearly do not right. get attached.
What do you think of Ross from Friends as their instructor?
Because there was Ross from Friends and then the guy from Office Space.
Yeah.
Like, right away. And I'm like, how do I even take this seriously? So,
but they were actually good choices, I feel. Like, both those guys, Ron Livingston and David Schwimmer, right? Like, they did great, I thought.
No, they were great, but they're so typecasted at this point. It's just hard to separate that out. At least
I see what you mean for sure. I thought the Schwimmer was great because he was so inept and he just looks like a weasel.
Oh,
no offense to Mr. Schwimmer, but he looks the part.
I mean, when you have the slick back hair and you just carry yourself as he does, I'm sure in other roles he doesn't look so much like a weasel. But
well, Livingston does just look like a privileged kid. You know what I mean? He looks like a guy who you might. Like, he's likable, but you also kind of want to punch him in the face, too, just for having more than you do.
Right? You're like, you have that nice angular jaw, and you got it all going on, the features and the way you carry yourself. And
in this cute kind of way.
I love you, and I hate you at the same time. Yeah. I want to be you, but I also want to be your friend, but I also kind of want to punch you in the face still.
Yeah.
It's a hard line to walk. Yeah.
Have you gotten to Jimmy Fallon's little cameo?
No. I mean, if I did, I haven't noticed, but
you'll notice. I think you'll notice.
My partner Anthony was he's like, I watch it every June for D-Day, and so I'm like, okay, I've never watched it. And well, you and I have talked about this with like Full Metal Jacket and Apocalypse Now, Saving Private Ryan. They're all movies I need to see and I want to see, but I won't do it on my own. Like, someone has to sit me down and say, we are watching this, just because I don't know what it is. I just can't. I won't watch war things on my own. Same with documentaries. you know, I tend towards fiction.
I'm the same way with Lady and the Tramp.
Yeah, you need me to come over and sit you down and we're going
to
watch.
Someone needs to.
To be fair, Billy, I find it one of the most boring Disney films out there, so I am not your girl for this, so I apologize.
Apology accepted. But I'm glad you're doing it, though.
Yeah, no, it's exciting, and like when they're jumping out of the planes for V-Day and their faces all, you know, greased up or whatever, and I was like, wait, who's that guy? Is that guy part of that thing? And is who did that one die? And I'm just like, they literally all look the same. So
imagine how it was for the real soldiers at D-Day. I'm sure they felt the same exact way.
Right, well, and that's the other thing that's so wild just watching this. And I don't.
Who's that guy? Is that guy a part of that thing that I was a part of? Where did that guy come from? I think I recognize that guy from somewhere.
505? Yeah. So I was just, but it's really made me think about these situations and obviously how different war is now. But all these guys that I'm like, I would worry I'd kill one of my own people. You know, all the friendly fire, which was a very real thing. Yeah. I'm like, how do you tell each other apart? And how do you tell who is who from all that distance? And then you have to relay all this information back to far, far, far away. Well, there's no satellite or cell phones or whatever. So
yeah,
it was just amazing how they did things. I think I made the comment, which is so off color, so you may want to delete this if you put it in. So I'm like, I feel like you had to be a lot smarter to be in the army back then.
Oh, like, I don't know about that.
They pull up.
It took my grandfather.
I don't know your grandfather.
It wasn't that bright.
Don't tell him you said that.
It wasn't that bright.
But I mean, just in general though, like you had to like have these maps and calculate things by hand. And it's, again, now just technology does so much for us.
Again, my grandfather couldn't figure out how to use YouTube. He couldn't figure out how to operate a cell phone. The guy was a dunce.
But I'm sure he was great with a map and compass.
Oh, he was awesome with a map.
Forceps.
But then all of a sudden, I didn't need those anymore. And I said, what are you doing, old man? What are you doing with that piece of paper and that sharp piece of metal? I don't need it. I don't need you. And then I left him in the woods on his way home.
He's laughing at you now because as soon as that cell phone dies, he's good to go and you're just screwed.
The thing is, I don't really think that they were smarter, but I do think that they were certainly made of a different material, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I still have the letters that my grandfather sent home. So he was, I think, 17 when he joined the military. He dropped out of high school, joined the army. His brother was at D-Day and got wounded, I guess, pretty bad. And mm-hmm. but recovered and then went back into battle and then disappeared, never to be seen again to this day.
Wow.
Yeah. And so my grandfather joined up. And I think his brother's still alive when he joined up, though. But it's weird reading letters from him because he writes letters to his high school class. And in those letters, he talks about how he, you know, how they had to fight their way into this town, how many people they had to kill just to have a warm place to sleep inside of a church because it was raining so bad. And that was what motivated them on one particular night of fighting. He also, I know he killed a few kids when he was over there, that really bothered him for the rest of his life. And it's really interesting to read this kind of stuff in these, letters. And then you think, then I work with kids now about that age and we've got this COVID virus thing going on, right? Mm-hmm. And the biggest sacrifice their generation is asked to make, stay at home. And hang out on your, you know, watch your YouTube and your TikTok videos. That's the sacrifice you can make for your country. It's the best thing you can do. Can't be bothered to do it. You know what I mean? A great majority of them just can't do it. You know, they're going nuts over this stuff.
Yeah.
And I just can't. That's the hard thing. I think that I'm smarter than my grandfather. I'll go on the record and say that. Maybe that's not true. That might not be true.
Than most people. So
that's not true either. But the thing, he was definitely made of something that I'm not made of. You know what I mean? I don't think I could do that.
No. And I remember when I was 17 and, again, very, very, very aware of history and the past and, you know, people and nostalgia being like, oh, it was so much better in my day. Da, da, da. And I mean, I think we're all very familiar with it. I feel like, this was really poignant to me when we would go to Gunther Tootie's, the 50s designer, and people would be like, now that was the time, great cars, everybody was prosperous. And then you're like, but extreme misogyny and racism and segregation and lynching. Then you're like, was it better?
Yeah.
But people forget about that stuff. But I remember one of my English classes wanted us to read, it was like an online thing, Tom Brokaw's The Greatest Generation. And I balked at it. And I was like, are you freaking kidding me? And as I've gotten older and we're living through all this stuff, and I'm like, man, maybe that really was the greatest generation, because they really could come together and they were willing to sacrifice and they could unite behind this one thing. And it seemed like a lot of the disparities between classes and races and genders it just was gone because they had one common enemy that they knew. It wasn't some unseen enemy. It was very, very real on, you know, both sides of the world. So
for sure. But the thing is, though, too, like you're very much right on the money, too, that there's always this dark side of it, too, that people really like to forget. And what a lot of people do forget about that era, particularly, because my grandparents also, along with that bravery, they also raised me with that real rosy-colored view of things, too, you know. Mm-hmm. But the deeper you dig into it, like my grandparents were extremely racist people. And also, that time in our history, I could be wrong, but from what I've read, that time in our history, we had the largest labor strikes in our nation's history during World War II. At the time when we were supposed to be our most united, we were paradoxically our most divided.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I did
so
not
when we
know
all
that.
Should just be like shutting up and going to work and making these bombs for the war effort, you selfish bastard. Everybody was saying, no, you assholes, I'm not going to go do that because you're exploiting us. You know,
and God, there's so many parallels with what's going on now. Like everybody, I have a very stressful job right now, you know, working with people.
What is it now?
So I assist people getting into drug and alcohol rehab, which is awesome. As you know, both sides of the coin for both of us, you know, we've lost people to addiction. I've struggled with addiction myself, you know, and falling into that rabbit hole. And so it's great to help people, but it is kind of a sales job too. Like I have certain goals to meet. It's easy for me because I just help people. We have goals, like so many people to get into treatment. But it's, again, it's a good, you're selling people hope. But at the same time, I've sent personal people in my life to treatment, to our facilities, and got firsthand feedback saying it's amazing. It's probably one of the best things out here. So that's great. But then there's that pressure from inside sales, and then plus dealing with people who want to go to treatment one day and then the next day don't, and then they ghost you and you're like, I'm just trying to help you. What is wrong with you? And just fighting them is causing a lot of anxiety. And then, mm-hmm. you know, just lived through the tornadoes and right. in Nashville, and then the COVID-19 pandemic going on, and then the Black Lives Matter movement, all the protests. So it's been really stressful, but on top of all of that, everybody's like, I'm so grateful for my job. I'm so grateful to be working. And I am, but at the same time, all this stuff is going on. And I feel like companies feel like they can exploit their workers because of it. Going back to that whole thing, yes, companies can say, well, you're lucky to have a job. You're lucky to work here. I remember being in that same position in 2008. Like I wanted to leave. I was ready to move on. I didn't want to be where I was. I was unhappy and I had so much anxiety like right now but I'm still supposed to be lucky to have that job. Instead
where
of
were
like,
you in 2008?
Hey, huh?
Where were you in 2008?
I was at, oh gosh, I was at the art store, and then I had just moved to the hospital actually, to Denver Health. And so that was 2009. So I moved to the hospital, Denver Health, and it was really stressful there for a while until I kind of found my niche and then, you know, settled in. I was actually pretty happy there in the long run. But yeah, you get to this point where I'm so lucky to have a job, and workers feel like, well, we can pay you whatever we want. You don't have to give you raises. You know, we can crack down harder on you because you're not going to leave because you know so many people are unemployed, and it's not okay.
No. And yeah. Luckily, I work for a company that's very small. I haven't experienced that here yet. But in 2008, I was working at a large hotel, and, you know, firsthand, I saw how they treated people. They did some great things, you know, organizing some food pantries for employees in need, things like that, I guess. But they also really use it as an excuse to get rid of people they just didn't like. You know, not necessarily right. bad workers or people who were liabilities because they were sexually harassing housekeepers. No, they just got rid of people who just rubbed them the wrong way a little bit too much, you know?
Yeah.
Those were the first to go. And that definitely sent a message to everybody else. Like, you could be next. You should be grateful. Shut up. Do what you're told. You know, yeah. And I can easily see why that would cause a lot of people to hit the streets in large protest, you know, and they didn't have the unemployment numbers that we have now. I mean, I think we're just at the tip of the iceberg on this thing.
Yeah. And that's scary because I'm like, I want to leave so badly. And
where would you go?
I know. That's the
problem. You mean the job or do you mean the country?
Oh, I mean both, but the job for now.
I get you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and you're right, like so many people, and maybe that's why they could strike. And, you know, back in the 40s or in World War II, is that there were jobs, there were plenty of jobs, and there was demand. But suddenly, if you're in a recession or a high unemployment market, they know they'll have plenty of people to fill those positions for a lot less than what they're paying you. And so you don't have the luxury. It's a luxury, really, at this point to go on strike, to stand up and walk out. You know, I tried a mild insurrection in my job place. I'm a bad
Did you now?
I tried amongst my team. I'm like, what would they do if we all just got up and walked out? How would they feel about their numbers then? And nobody would stand up with me. It was fine. And it wouldn't matter if I was just one person, but a lot of people there are so money driven, whereas I'm, you know, altruistically driven, that they wouldn't walk out because, you know, yeah. They walk out, there's money. For me, you know, I walk out, it's about being treated properly. And I think that's the thing with our generation. We can't get it together to do that. And I don't know why. You know, this big quote unquote, they feels like they've divided us, you know, they're so into singularity, like we are special. Each person is an individual and that we have a hard time finding some sort of common cause or reason to unite ourselves together, where we just have lost that perspective. I don't know. I still rack my brain every day thinking about that.
You're not the first for sure. And I'm sure not the last. I don't know that there is an answer, is there? You know, I think that there are some problems that are uniquely American, for sure. And our culture is young, but it's very strong and very pervasive. And that's, one of the things I really like to talk about on the podcast. You hit a few things, even though you haven't heard this version yet, you hit on a few things that have been huge themes, nostalgia and culture. I really think that culture drives a lot more than we realize. I think that culture drives things that we can't escape. You know what I mean? Even though you and I are a few generations removed from our European ancestors, a lot of how they lived, how they thought, how they acted still affect us to this day. Mm-hmm. You know, the same way it does for a Chinese person or a Russian person or a Native American. There's just certain things within cultures that we just can't escape. And I really am trying to hit on what it is about the American experience that is unique. I mean, there's the obvious stuff, right? That we are a nation of immigrants along with Native Americans. We have different waves of migration, more so than certain other countries, more than some, less than others. So we have our own unique struggles, I suppose. So in some ways, I think people would hit you on the head and say, well, no wonder we can't get along, stupid. We got too many Mexicans, too many Italians, too many, you know, substitute, whatever, too many whites. But I just feel like it's not that simple, though, right? Like, I feel like we've always struggled with what our national identity is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I do think that you hit on the topic of a they, and I want to ask you about that, too. But I think there is a they. And I do think that, I can't say that I'm a Marxist, but there's some things in the Marxist point of view that I really identify with that I think I have more in common with someone of my economical station in South America than I do with a rich white guy in this country. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Even though we are both Americans, we share the same culture, we both like baseball, whatever. I think I have more in common with that middle-ish class kind of guy in Brazil than I do with a rich white American. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, that's a lot to unpack.
Sorry.
So America as an identity, I think, yeah, no, right. And I know you and I have spoken about this before. I think, yes, we are a nation built on immigration, but more importantly, I hate to say it, and incredibly topical right now, but we are a country built on slavery, on extreme slavery, on slavery in a modern world, and in a way that happened nowhere else in the world. You know, that is uniquely American, and that may be the one thing that really sets us apart from other nations, because sure, you have colonialism. You know, we chased out and, you know, methodically killed the Native Americans, basically, and are still oppressing them to this day. And, you know, that's happened all over the world by almost every other, really, culture. You don't even have to say Western civilization. It happens everywhere. But when it comes to the institution of slavery that America created, this just giant machine, incredibly profitable machine, I think that is uniquely American. And I think that is why we are experiencing what we're experiencing right now, whether it's, you know, economic differences or, you know, poverty and economic disparity, you know, between economic classes or race or even gender. I think we perfected the art of keeping the rich, white, and powerful at the top, you know, and I think it's inherently human, and I really can't take credit for this idea. It was a professor from where I went to my undergrad was saying, it was a Civil War class, that when there were slaves, can I curse on this podcast?
Yeah, why not?
Okay. The shittiest of shittiest, lowest, most garbage white person was still better than someone, or better than a slave. And suddenly you free the slaves and they're productive, incredible individuals with a lot of grit. You know, they're free. And man, they really, but you know, before Reconstruction ended, like, things were actually really freaking good for them compared to what they'd had, especially. And then Reconstruction ended and everything went tits up. But suddenly slaves were free and they were doing pretty well. And then that shittiest of shit, lowest garbage white human is not better than someone. And they are really at the bottom. And that is not okay. And that's when you see that segregation and the arrival of the Ku Klux Klan and all these groups that, you know, have to oppress someone because they don't want to be the bottom. Nobody wants to be the bottom. Everybody wants to be at the top. I'm pretty happy with like second or third, because then I'm not like, you know, anybody's target. I'm happy with middle management, but yeah. So, and that's why, you know, we have things like segregation and why this still pervades, because women became a threat. You know, suddenly they're doing what you can do and better. And if you're so used to winning all the time, it really sucks to lose. I mean, imagine Boston fans when the Patriots lose. Like, they don't know what to do with themselves. You know, it's despair. Yeah. You're so used to winning, and it's hard to lose. And if you've been winning for hundreds of years, you know, how long has the patriarchy really been around? A long time. And I'm not even coming from this like a super feminist point of view. Like, it's true. It's history. Who rules? White men. Still true. I mean, less than 10% of women are in CEO positions around the world. And yeah, there's more of us. So there's a lot of things to unpack with that, but you always have these white men at the top, and it's, I don't know. I'm going down a rabbit hole here.
No, so it's like, okay.
Oh, where's my train of thought going? Bring me back.
Let's pull out some strings a little bit there. So, you know a lot about this stuff. Let me get into your background a little bit. So history, right? Is that what you got your undergrad in?
Yeah, history with a minor in fine arts.
Minor in fine arts. So your interest primarily was pottery, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Ceramics,
So what got you interested in that initially?
Which one? All of it? All of the above?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
I mean,
I meant this ceramic specifically. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I guess ceramics, I did a lot of it in high school and I just really enjoyed it. And especially the pottery wheel, that was just very, it's just very calming and soothing. I could kind of
ever since that movie Ghost, everyone wanted to make pottery.
Not gonna lie, I named my first gerbil Molly after Demi Moore from Ghost.
Oh,
yes.
God.
True story. True story. And by the way, what she's building on the pottery wheel is really freaking hard. So I'm kind of annoyed she destroyed it. But anyway, it's a good movie. Come on, Billy, don't judge me.
It's not bad. It's not bad.
But yeah, got into it in high school. And then when I went to Metropolitan State University of Denver, I was going to be a photojournalist. That's what I wanted to do because I got really into photography in high school and really the whole arts scene. And photojournalism is a dying field, if not dead by now.
Tell me about it. That was my major.
Exactly. So that's when digital cameras started coming around and anybody could take a photo or video with, you know, as the cell phones were getting better and better. And I realized, okay, this is a dying thing. I need to find something else. Well,
Jesus, you have more foresight than I did.
Well, it's a big reason I didn't go to art school for photography either, because it was just on the verge of digital photography getting like a real foothold and actually becoming decent. So anyway, I take my first history class, and I've always been interested in history, really since a small kid. History and politics. You know, I remember talking to a family friend, and I was like, I could actually, or so I thought, hold a conversation about the election between Clinton and Bob Dole back in 96. And I was like, I'm really interested in this stuff, so I'm trying to follow it. Little 8-year-old me, even asking my mom, who did you vote for? I'm pretty sure she voted for Clinton. Sorry, mom, outing you here. but I've always been interested in history, and I took my history class at Metro, and I believe it was Europe after the 1600s or something like that, or Western civilization after the 1600s. And I had Dr. Kim Klimek, who's the most amazing, wonderful, powerful woman I've ever met, and her medieval history was her thing. And it really sparked something in me. I'm like, okay, well, there's all these things I like to study. Like, I'm really good at philosophy, art history, but I promised my husband then no useless degrees. Philosophy and art history both fall under those categories, unfortunately. Psychology, I didn't want to do anything that came out of that career, but history, there was this whole list of things that I'd be good at that. I would love that. And so that's how I got into the history portion of it and just decided this has to be my major. I can follow this through to a career. And I also accepted that if I do this, I'm probably going to have to get a master's, which I was vehemently against, obviously, when I started school. Because who signs up for like 20 years of school?
Back then, no one. But now it's everyone. Becoming, I guess a different subject.
Yeah.
So no, when did you first go to Tunisia?
Oh, gosh. That was 2012. Summer of 2012.
Okay.
Yeah, I was studying Renaissance art in Italy. It's like the most privileged thing to say. But I mean, I was lucky enough to do it. So, spent some time in Florence and Rome. And I had some friends in Tunisia. And got to visit and I've been 3 times now.
So totally. that was just for pleasure. I always assumed it was for your degree.
No, it was
I always thought you were digging up graves in Tunisia and looking at pottery.
No, but funny you say that. So I met these friends on Skype, believe it or not. It was just people, this is 2010 when I met them. So I've been friends with them 10 years now, but they wanted to learn English a little bit better. So, you know, pretty blonde, you know, hanging out on Skype, and they're like, teach me English. So ended up becoming really, really good friends. And I've, like I said, visited 3 times now, and from a friendship forged on Skype, strangely enough.
People and just hang out on Skype?
They used to.
I didn't know that. I was never invited.
Sorry, but I'll send you an invitation. I can hang out on Skype. I would, for you, Billy the World. But they took them to all these museums, and I was pointing out, I'm like, okay, so there's a mosaic, and this is what it means, and then here's this bit of pottery, and this is what it means. And my two friends just always looked at each other and said, she knows more about our history than we do. So
I used to get that on Ukraine a lot too.
Yeah.
Sometimes it takes an outsider to appreciate it more. Yeah, you take it for granted. I've never been skiing. Everyone comes to Colorado and they love this stuff. What the fuck? I don't care. It's a big mountain. Get over it.
It's pretty. I look at it. That's for tourists and foreigners. But everyone's like, what's there fun to do in Colorado? I'm like, I don't know.
And I know nothing about local news. I never watch local news. I don't know what's going on down the street, but I know what's going on in Tunisia. I probably know more about Tunisia than Colorado.
Possibility. I know enough about Colorado and obviously history because it's always been my thing, but European history was always the big one for me though.
So then what led to the master's degree? What did you end up getting your master's in?
Conservation of museum and archaeological objects. And I have learned how to say that at the pub after a few pints pretty well. So it's an important skill to have, especially in England. So back to Dr. Kim Klimek, the medieval historian. Mm-hmm. Never thought I'd like medieval history and just grew incredibly in love with it. And seeing how many things in our language, especially, but in our culture, in our technology still come from medieval times. It's wild to connect those dots still. But she was standing in class one day and she was talking about how she went to, for her doctoral thesis, she got to go to England and to London and to Paris to study medieval manuscripts. Now, medieval manuscripts are made out of vellum, which is really, really, really thinly basically shaved and cured animal skin. It was very precious. And usually I think it was calf skin, I believe. And so in London, they made her use white cotton gloves to turn the pages. And in Paris, they made her wash her hands really well and she could touch it with her fingers, citing that the oil from her fingers actually helped the vellum.
Of course, they would say that in Paris. Saucy monkeys.
I may be taking the side of the French here on this one because it's true. And white cotton gloves, you run the risk of catching the corners or getting fibers on something or whatever. So they each have their merits. Paper conservators will generally tell you use washed hands rather than white cotton gloves. But she said that and just like this light bulb went off in my head. I just remember it so vividly. I remember the classroom even, practically what she was wearing. I'm like, that's what I want to do. I want to be able to touch all that stuff. I don't necessarily need to read it. I want to touch it. And that was the thing. I'd always go to museums and like, you know, they say, do not touch art. And I'm like, I want to touch that. I didn't become a painting conservator. I just want to put it out there that there's many types of conservators. Painting is kind of like the big flashy one. You know, it's the one everybody thinks of. I mean, you remember the movie Ghostbusters too. Like she's in there with her little like glasses, like cleaning the painting. What I love, Dana from Ghostbusters, she was in a symphony. She was a professional cellist. Yeah. And suddenly now she's a painting conservator. I'm like, man, she must be like 60 years old to be at those levels professionally.
Yeah, Renaissance woman, for real.
Right? So not a painting conservator, but I do get to touch all the objects and put together ancient Roman pottery and, you know, play with $2 million objects, basically like moon rocks from space. The original ones brought back.
So fascinating. It's
fun. It's incredible. It's such a privilege to be able to do something like that, really.
So you went to grad school in England?
Yes, Durham, England. It's a little medieval city just south of Newcastle.
So what made you choose this university?
Oh, God, so many reasons. Well, first of all, the grad programs in the States, there's not a lot of grad programs, period, for conservation. Mm-hmm. And all the ones in the States required, this is so, we should talk about the American university system one of these days, but they required a fine arts degree with like a minor in chemistry, basically, which I did not have. I mean, who goes to school saying, I'm going to do fine arts and chemistry? Not many people.
Right.
So I didn't want to go back for another 2 years to do that, basically, at least the chemistry part. And then they also required so many hours as an intern. Most internships are unpaid in this country to even get in. Like you basically had to have worked full time in a conservation position as an intern to even get into grad school. And I'm like, I'm going to grad school to learn how to be a conservator. I don't need to be one before I get in. And it's very selective, very competitive. And so I'm like, I don't even qualify. But I've always wanted to go to school out of the country. My main goal in life is to get out of the United States. And I did it for a while. And I looked at all the programs all over England. And this one, it just seemed like a good fit, you know, with the program. And it really was. It's a phenomenal program. And I guess Durham is like the top, is the third, number three school in the UK. Like, obviously, it's like Oxford and Cambridge. And then Durham. I had no idea until I got there, but it's a really, really good school. I'm like, again, middle management. I can live with number three. Nobody's heard That's of great. Durham. They all know Oxford and Cambridge, but I'm okay with Durham. So it was a great program, and they liked bringing in people from all sorts of backgrounds. Like, some people had a background in art. Most people had a background in archaeology. Some people had, you know, more experience working in a museum versus a certain educational background, but the professor wanted to bring a lot of people together that had different backgrounds and play off of each other's strengths. Like, so I barely did any archaeology, so I had archaeologists there that, you know, I could learn from.
I think, you know, you ask a lot of kids, boys and girls, and they would say that that's a dream job. It's just something I think a lot of people would love to do. What is the job market like once you finish a program like that? What is it like for World of Conservation?
A lot of that does depend on where you're at in the world, of course. In England, they do have actual facility positions or institution positions, like literally going to work for the National Art Gallery or National Museum of Wales or Scotland, excuse me. You know, all of the big institutions, and there's some private practice, but there are jobs. They don't pay great, but in England you can live off of a lower salary for, you know, it's a decent quality of life, unlike here in the States. Like, minimum wage there, you can survive okay. But in the States, it's because it's so niche, you know, there isn't a ton of competition for jobs. That also means that there isn't a ton of institutional positions either, because conservators are expensive. You know, again, we're so specialized. And a lot of arts don't, you know, arts and culture do not have the funding to have enough staff or positions. So conservation is often something they contract out, which is how I got the position where I'm at in Nashville, Tennessee, helping open the State Museum. Now it's open, so now I'm not in that job. But it was all contracted work.
And so that's the thing. Like, everybody's, I do contract work, education. Yeah. I mean, everybody's contracting with everything.
Yeah.
Everyone is signing contracts with everybody. Like, when did we get to this
point? No benefits. It's because employers, once again, it's that employers don't want to pay benefits. They don't want really the liability of people. It's more expensive to hire someone on than it is to contract them. Some might argue. I might argue the other way, but and sometimes you only need people for a short amount of time. But it is a workaround to really taking care of workers and their needs. And they have a lot less legal protection under working laws, under things like OSHA and labor laws.
I understand all of that. I mean, I really do. I guess I understand the incentives. Just how did we let ourselves get to this point? I think the same with healthcare. It's just like, how do we do this to each other? Yeah. You know what I mean? Talking about something that's American. Like, we're really good at doing stuff like this. And we tend to England's export it to other countries. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like, England's really the zero-hour contract, quote unquote. But as for the job thing, how did we get here? We wanted jobs and we wanted money. And once again, we kind of go back to that unionizing and labor force. If you get us into a place where, like in America, if you don't have a job, you are screwed. There are no social benefits for us. It's so hard to get unemployment. And if you do, it's a fraction of what you make. You don't have health care. Like, there are just no social benefits. So I think we're much more desperate to have a job than I think a lot of other places. So yeah, as a conservator, it would be contract work. And I tell you, Billy, that causes me so much anxiety. I knew that this job was going to end, and in 2.5 years it was going to end. And day one, I had anxiety about it. I hated it because I know that I'm a good employee. If I show up, I'll have a job. You know, that's never really been an issue for me. And it drove me insane. And I knew that being an entrepreneur and a small business person, I need to know where my paycheck is going to come. It's going to show up, going to be in my bank account, and I'll have that job. And I can't. And now I'm very, very glad for what I do, because if I was in the museum field, I'd be done. I'd be out of a job. So things worked out in that sense. But
for sure.
Yeah, it's everything's contract work now with things like conservation. It's good money. It's really good money if you can do it. And I couldn't.
So. Do you wish that you would have stayed in England?
Yeah.
Was that an option?
No, I mean, unless I got married.
That's it? That was it?
Mm-hmm. Or got someone to sponsor me. And because of what I do, again, unless I was a doctor or some sort of software engineer or physicist, something that is really high in demand, but not a lot of people do it, then yes, I could have stayed. But I'm not that person. I'm really specialized at what I do, but I'm not high in demand. So, because again, it's the arts. It's very underfunded and people deem it not important at the end of the day. So
it's a pity, isn't it?
It is. It is a pity.
Can't think of another word for it.
Damn shame.
I'm glad you're doing okay now. I just, you know, it's a shame because again, I remember, you know, how much you love doing it. And again, it just sounds like such a dream job in so many ways. And I really feel like there's a bigger apparatus out there working against us to live our dreams, all of us.
Yeah.
And I think that's really kind of sad. But I guess you could always open up your own museum. It's a possibility.
I mean, it is. There's very few restrictions on what actually counts as a museum or not. I mean, I want to say in Colorado, there's a teddy bear museum. There's always the weird doll museums. But I know that. So
what's the best museum you've ever been to?
Oh, Billy, that's a good question.
Really?
Oh man, that is a hard one. That is a really hard one. The National Museum of Scotland is pretty amazing, but there was this one, the Borgello, and it was in Florence, Italy. And I really remember being there, and this was before I went to grad school, and I saw all these little items, like little combs and little clocks and just everyday use items. Of course, they're like the high-end ones for the time, and I'm talking like old, you know, 500 plus years old. And I'm like, I want to clean that. That's what I'm going to do. And I did, and I got to do that sort of thing. So again, had my dream job, can still have my dream job. You know, it may be a matter of taking a different course. Like, I really want to learn how to conserve pinball machines and probably to restore them.
So. Again, this you're preaching to the choir here, and you're hitting on themes that we've been dealing with since day one. You even mentioned Gunther Tooties. So when I first started doing the podcast, you know, I'm renting space where I do the podcast out of. This is before COVID, and in that parking lot is a Gunther Tooties. So all my early guests, I would treat them to lunch there first, and we would go and record. And of course, inevitably, we would talk a lot about nostalgia and Gunther Tooties and things like that, because that's what its function is, right? It's a nostalgia machine, a restaurant with a bunch of crazy 1950s posters on the wall and stuff like that that feels vaguely 50s, but you know that it's not, right? Because you know that 50s restaurants didn't have all the latest movie posters from the 50s on the wall, right? And right. All the lunch boxes on the wall, right? Like, by design, it's similar, but the inside, right. There's something about it, it's a little ersatz, right? Like, there is something inauthentic about it.
Right.
And so, I mean, it must be really weird for people who actually lived through the 50s to go there. I wonder how they feel.
You know, that's a good question. I've never heard anyone complain about it. I feel neither. Like it is, it's their nostalgia. Like,
so do you think they'll have something like that for the 90s? Will they have Gunther Tooties for the 90s for people like you and me when we're in our 90s?
I'm trying to think. I feel like we already have that. I mean, I love how when it comes to fashion and culture, how we have these cycles. I mean, and I know it's a lot with fashion, How like the 90s came back for a minute, or the 80s are coming back. I think the 70s are really coming back.
Yes, but I'm tying this directly into your specialty as a conservationist here, because I'm not just talking about fads that tend to return. I'm talking about a place where people go to get a certain sensation about a certain era, operated, owned, and run by people who have never lived in that era or been anywhere even close to it.
You know what it's going to be. Somebody's going to open, was it the Park Street Perk, Park Avenue Perk, the cafe from Friends, the coffee shop.
I brought that up on a podcast. And as far as someone I know, they've done this. Oh, they've done it.
I'm not surprised in any way.
I swear I've seen articles where they've done this all over the world, I think, actually. Yeah. Oh, totally. And I'm actually surprised that there's not more of it. I'm surprised that there's not more exact replicas of Monk's from Seinfeld, that there's not, you know,
Cheers
in every fucking street, you know, like, or in every city. Like, I'm really surprised there's not more of these things, because we love this stuff, don't we? Like, we really love to, you know, that the definition of nostalgia, right? It comes from this ancient Greek word that means return home. I mean, it's such a beautiful thought, isn't it?
That is,
yeah, that's literally what it means, return home. And you can understand why it's a fucking ancient word to begin with, right? This is something that's a human issue. It's not just Americans. Mm-hmm. It's not just us who grew up in the 90s. The ancient Greeks felt nostalgic, you know. This is something that every human kind of deals with. So I'm fascinated by it as a concept, because I think you're the one who always reminds me of that Tony Soprano quote, right? It's something about reminiscing being the lowest form of conversation.
Yeah, I still love that line. Oh my God.
So do I
said it to someone the other day.
It's a beautiful line, you know? And of course, I think it was just his way of dismissing someone that he didn't want to have a conversation with.
Right.
Because he's a very nostalgic person, I sense. Mm-hmm. You know, he loved his Gary Cooper movies, you know, and he was a dinosaur, right? I think that's what that whole show is kind of about, right? Like his time and his people's time were passing, you know, and he really kind of missed the way it used to be. We all do.
Right. But I think that line for him was him coming to realize that moment, that self-actualization of times, they are a changing. And these past stories aren't going to help anyone. You know, they're not going to change the fact that, you know, they are a dying breed, and that things have to, you know, if they keep talking about the past, they're going to be totally unaware of what's coming at them from the future.
So then as a historian, why does it matter? The history.
Oh God. Yeah. Hey Billy, how much time do we have?
I know we're getting deep. We'll bring it back. You can come back.
No, it's a very relevant point, and I think this frustrates me on the daily. And again, I don't know how topical you want to be, but I basically describe, I'm doing web programming and coding as the next career, the thing that's going to support me while I do conservation on the side. I do enjoy it, though. It's hard, but I really enjoy it. So my tutor is this 23-year-old white guy out in Utah, like as white as it gets. Very sweet though, but I don't read books. He's like, I straight up just don't like to read books. I'm like, well, at least you're aware of it and can admit it and don't see it as a bad thing. It's just not your thing. He's like, I don't watch the news. I'm not on social media. So what is all this George Floyd thing about? So I kind of explain it. Yeah. He's like, he just didn't know. So
Just the incident in Minneapolis. No big deal.
Yeah.
Let's go back.
The world's burning because of it. But you know,
where do you even start with that? That's nuts.
But I mean, I did. And so like for once I was actually tutoring him. So that kind of felt like a nice turn of the tables. So, but basically, and I've had this conversation with several, some really open to it, but then a lot of other people who aren't as open to why this is important. Why is this happening? Why now? It was just one person. The cops have been, you know, charged and fired, and isn't that justice? And so I'm like, listen up. And I really have to condense it down to 5 minutes of why racism is systemic and why it's a problem and why it's everywhere. And as a white person, it's really hard to feel it because it's not against us. And that doesn't make us jerks and doesn't make us racist. It just we're unaware, and then we become aware and we're like, oh shit, like this is actually is a problem. History is important because we really do repeat it all the time. In explaining this systemic racism, I have to take them back to slavery. And like I, you know, recounted earlier about Reconstruction and then segregation and then the civil rights movement and how it's always about someone being on top. And we can see that through history. And if we see that in the history, then we get an understanding of why we're here today. Yes, we have made progress. People aren't slaves anymore. That's good progress, but it's not enough. And I think when we but we're backsliding too. And I don't want to sound like super anti-Trump or never Trumper kind of person, but there's certain boxes that are being checked. And for my senior thesis at Metro, I wrote about how the labor party, or not the party, the laboring class, you know, your blue collar workers, your socialists and your communists at the time helped the Nazis rise to power, or how they didn't. And they actually didn't. They were big opponents to Hitler becoming as powerful as he did. And that was a surprise to me. They always spin it that, oh, he brought up the weak and the poor and helped them out. And it was quite the opposite.
More of a top down. It was a top down.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that upper middle class to lower upper class kind of echelon.
You got the bankers, you got the moneyed people to finance the whole project.
The big industrial bosses, you know, it wasn't about the labor. And so there's a lot of boxes that this parallel between Trump and Hitler is checking in history. And it's like, if you look at it, it's really scary in that, like, the limiting of the press, because that is happening, creating an enemy that is unseen, that you know, really isn't there. This propaganda and all these things. And like, that was a big thing I'm worried about is this upcoming election is, are we even going to get an election? If we do vote him out, is he going to leave? Because there's so many things leading up to this that just parallel what happened in Germany up to this big economic crisis, inequality, just this fear mongering that's been going on, that there's just too much similar that it's people need to take notice.
I know what you mean. I do what you mean. One good thing is, you know, the protests that are going on because of George Floyd at the White House, it does give you some glimmer of hope. You know, there's a dress rehearsal right now going on.
Yeah.
For November, if he doesn't leave, you know, and he's scared.
Torches, baby, it's coming.
He's very clearly scared. You know, I said this in a blog post earlier this week that I think the governor of Minnesota, for all the Trumpisms and Trump tweets, I think the governor of Minnesota has the quotes of the 2020s. And it was when the National Guard backed down over the protesters. Mm-hmm. He said, there's simply more of them than there are of us. It's like, you're damn right.
Yeah.
You know, don't fucking forget it, pal.
Right.
And I think that there's one glimmer of hope about that, about Trump not going away, is that this is a dress rehearsal. People are getting ready for just that possibility.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that people are not backing down. You know, the protests haven't been perfect, and they've definitely have had things to be criticized. But it's in many ways it's beautiful to see.
It is, and that is, and that's what I was talking about. Unity. We're finding that unity. You know, and it's going to become larger than just Black Lives Matter at this point. If we keep up the momentum, you know, and we don't get distracted. And we back each other, you know. I think eventually we're kind of come to realize too that money isn't even real. If this pandemic comes back with a vengeance, it's eventually gonna get to the point like, well, what's the point? Money isn't even real. I, you know, don't have a job. I can't pay you. You can't pay this. This person isn't making any money off of this. So if we all just stop paying each other, we'll be fine. But
that's what I'm saying. You know, this whole thing started over a leaky counterfeit $20 bill, you know. This cheap piece of paper with some dead white dude's picture on it. Like, that's what this was all about. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's what it's all about, isn't it? Dirty paper with dead white dude's pictures on it. Like, that's all it is. You know, we have so much faith in just this garbage. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it was the gangster Bugsy Siegel who said that it was, so what? It's dirty paper. I can always get more, you know? Like, that's it's all it is, right?
Yeah, it really is. There's nothing to back it up but our faith in it. And I think a lot of people's faith in not just the system, but our economy is eroding, or the structure of it. And so if this isn't a wake-up call to how much lacking our social benefits are, our labor rights, like all these things that Europe kind of has on lock, you know, after having lived there, I'm like, they got it down. Their system is not perfect. It is by no means flawless, but it's better. I mean, you don't hear about people there freaking out that, yes, their economy is crippled, but you don't hear about people being worried about getting evicted. You don't hear them worried about, can I go to the doctor? You know, there's some serious economic struggles there, but at the same time, the people aren't terrified the way they are here. I mean, people are getting evicted from their apartments left and right.
How's it in Nashville? Can you give me some news on the ground in Nashville?
I mean, man, like I said, first it was the tornado, then the pandemic, and then the protests, and we just can't get a break, it feels like. But I mean, the whole city is based on tourism and bars and eating out. Like, there's not the same kind of arts and culture that there are in a lot of other big cities. I mean, Broadway with the honky tonks is like the thing, with the Grand Ole Opry, you know, things like that. So with all that being closed, so many people I know are out of jobs. But then again, the outbreak here hasn't been bad. Our mayor was smart enough to shut down the city early, unlike our governor, which nobody can see me, but I'm rolling my eyes really hard right now. But we didn't have a horrible outbreak, thank goodness. That being said, you know, people aren't being that smart about it either. So we'll see. But yeah, the honky tonks are back opening up, and people on Broadway just on their stupid pedal taverns, you know, woohoo, all the bachelorette parties, getting shit faced. And
business as usual.
Business as usual.
So then where does tie this around to that lifestyle and to your history in museums? Where does Graceland rank on your list of greatest museums?
It's funny you bring that up, because by the way, Billy, Graceland is in Memphis, which is about 3 hours west of here. But it's funny you bring that up. I have a 7-year-old niece, and her dad hates Elvis. And so, you know, for a while she decided to hate Elvis, and she knew that I hated country music. So for a while she hated country music, but she said, Aunt Lala, I really want to go to Graceland. Can we go to Graceland when I come visit you? I'm like, okay. But instead of that, how about we go to Dollywood, which is Dolly Parton's amusement park. I've never been, but I really want to go. So
that would be great, I guess. But that's not really a museum, right? Can we learn anything from Dollywood? I don't know.
Absolutely.
Can we?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know what. I don't know.
You'll have to tell me. I expect a full report.
Oh, absolutely. I really want to go, because there are zero amusement parks around here. I had to drive to Ohio, fly to Ohio in order to go to a decent amusement park. So
imagine that. No amusement parks. No parks for human amusement.
All of this land, and they're not doing anything decent with it.
I feel like the whole city's a giant amusement park.
But yeah, no Graceland. I mean, why not? Why not? But yeah, God, I don't even think I answered your, like, Bargello in Italy.
Yeah, how it ranks. How it ranks as a museum.
How it ranks, yeah.
Have you been?
To Graceland?
Yeah.
No. No,
I kind of thought it was mandatory to get residency there. I thought that's where their DMV was, actually, at Graceland.
Well, fun fact, I still have a Colorado license, so that maybe.
Oh, that's why. That's probably why.
Now I know. That's maybe why I don't have a license. I haven't gone to Graceland yet.
Yeah. So. Well, yeah, when you want to get a permanent address there, I think you do have to go to Graceland.
Oh, gosh.
That's the capital, right? Isn't that where the governor operates out of? I realize there's so little I know about Tennessee.
Well, Nashville is the capital. It's in the very center of the state. Memphis is west. Knoxville is east. If you look at the flag, there's three stars on it. And it's not like a perfect triangle. It kind of sits askew so that it shows that none of these cities are better than the other. They're all equal, and how important that is.
That's what that's for.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, fun little Tennessee history. Actually, to be fair, Tennessee is a really cool state. I never thought Billy, if you had told me 5 years ago that I was going to be living in the South in Nashville, Tennessee, I would have told you to go fuck yourself and take a long walk off a short cliff. And here I am. I mean, I do plan on leaving. This isn't home forever, but it is a fascinating state with a ton of really important history. Like the right to vote came from Tennessee for women, the right to vote. The right to vote for women, I should say.
Ah, those just for those people.
For those people. But so here's how the story goes. So, you know, we needed, what, 2/3 of a vote in Congress or the Congress or the Senate to get the amendment passed, 20th Amendment passed. And it was equally divided. Like, they needed just one more state to push that vote over to get it passed. So in the Tennessee state legislature, it was divided 50-50, exactly down the middle. Half wanted it, half didn't want the vote for women. And so this mom, her, you know, young, strong son with a spring in his step down at the Capitol in Nashville, she writes him, she says, "My dearest Bobby," I don't know his name, "My dearest Bobby, I've always taken care of you. Now it is time to take care of your dear mother. I think you should vote for the right for women to vote." And little Bobby Dearest did. He swung the vote, and Tennessee was the 32nd state, I believe it was, to say, yes, we should allow women to vote. And had it not been for that, women had the right to vote.
That's
for
a cool story. Good for Bobby. Good for Bobby.
Good what for a, Bobby.
Good for his mom for not being an abusive jerk. Otherwise, he would have just thrown it in the trash, and you ladies wouldn't have any say in whether or not Trump goes in November.
I'm never coming home, Mom. You're mean.
Exactly, Carla, thank you so much for stopping by. This was great. I think we covered a lot of good territory. This was one of my favorite podcasts. So come back soon, will you?
Always. For you, Billy, the world. We've got a lot of amazing things. Yeah. It's not a problem. How many knows we're brain? It's all our fault. Choices.